you're a fan of 70s pop and rock and music of Emerson, Lake and Palmer, the Beatles, and Yes, then you're probably familiar with the work of Robert Moog. He wasn't a band member, but the creator of the Moog synthesizer, the instrument that ushered in the era of electronic music. A physicist and electrical engineer by training, Moog created the Moog 3, the Mini Moog, the Prodigy, the Liberation, the Poly Moog, instruments that allowed musicians to create sounds even he never imagined. You're listening right now to Hey Sue, Joy of Man's Desire, written by Bach and performed here with a Moog synthesizer by the composer Walter Carlos, now known as Wendy. And he becomes a pop music star in his own right, taking a classical music piece like the one you're listening to, Yesu Man's of Desiring. Let's listen to some more of that. Robert Moog died this week in North Carolina at the age of 71. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to pay tribute to him and to his pop music legacy. If you'd like to talk about Robert Moog or the Moog synthesizer, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guest. Lawrence Fritz is a professor of composition and theory and the director of the Electronic Music Studios at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. He joins us from his office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Fritz.
Hi, Ira. Glad to be here.
He certainly was a pioneer. He changed the face of music, did he not?
Absolutely. Just listening to the Carlos piece a few seconds ago, I was reminded really what a shock it was in my teenage years to hear Switched on Bach and to hear what the Moog synthesizer was capable of. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it was a tremendously profound impact across music.
How did he start out? And what got him on this line of work, moving in this direction?
He started out, amazingly enough, building theremins in high school. A theremin is a musical instrument that was invented in the 1920s by Leon Theremin in Russia. And it involves two antennas moving your hands. The performer moves their hands in relation to those and alters pitch and frequency and creates this sort of... War of the Worlds.
Yeah, that's that spooky music you always used to hear, and wee.
That was it. And so he figured out how to make these and started building kits, and reportedly sold more than 1,000 kits to finance his college education.
Mm-hmm. And so then, where he moved on from then?
So then he moved on, developed the idea of taking an oscillator. An oscillator is. An electrical device that produces a waveform and a frequency, mm-hmm. and they've been around for quite some time. Mm-hmm. He took a bundle of oscillators, hooked them together, and enabled the performer to control them with what we call a control voltage. So for the first time, a keyboard player like Wendy Carlos is then able to change the pitch of the oscillator in real time to create a performance.
Mm-hmm. I understand you bumped into him in your career at some point.
This is the most amazing story. So Bob Moog is an engineer above all. So when I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, he was there working on a prototype for the composer John Eaton, who I was studying with, a prototype of a multiple touch-sensitive keyboard. And an initial performance went well, and everything was fine. But then over the next week, he and I were both working in the studios. I was working on my composition, mm-hmm. and he was sitting across the hall with no pencil or paper, no tools. He just had this thing taken apart, and he was just staring at it. First night, that's all he did. Stared at it for 4 hours and went home. Second night, came in and stared at it for 4 hours and went home. Third night, was staring at it, came across to my office and asked for a hacksaw and sawed off a 5/8-inch piece of metal, which I still have. So, man of few words, not a complicated set of notes and diagrams, you know, just pure brain power.
I want to play that piece we started out with, Yesu Joy of Man's Desire, Desiring, and I want, let's see if I can, Matt can get that up. Tell us as we listen to it how this demonstrates the capabilities of the Moog synthesizer.
If you listen very carefully, during the attack of each note, you'll hear a little chiff, a little ch-ch sound. That's a deliberate placement of the noise component, white noise, they call it. And that's an integral part of Carlos's synthesis technique, is to introduce noise components at the very attack of a note. You'll also notice a little detuning that causes the oscillators to be a little out of tune and produces a great amount of richness. It's sort of like a choral effect when you have three singers all slightly out of tune. And finally, the listeners should know that this wasn't recorded simultaneously, that this was a monophonic instrument, meaning it could only play one note at a time. So she was playing literally one line on a recorder and then backing it up and multi-tracking and playing along with that.
Wow.
Yeah, but to my ears, maybe those chips, those attacks, are maybe a little over-exaggerated now from a 2005 standpoint, as opposed to a 1968 standpoint.
Wow, I never realized that about playing the one note at a time.
Yeah.
So you really had to be a technician also, not just, you know, put your fingers on a keyboard.
That's right, yeah. So you had to know something about the physics of sound. You had to know how oscillators worked. You had to know what the different characteristics were of waveforms. You would take a waveform that would have a certain wave, like on an oscilloscope. I've seen many pictures where Bob is working with his synthesizer hooked up to an oscilloscope. And if you see a smooth, wavy wave, that's a sine wave, and that produces a certain sound. Other waves are more angular. The more angular a wave is, the richer it is in frequency and harmonic content. So what the Moog synthesizer does is a technique called subtractive synthesis. You send the module of the oscillator into a filter, and then the filter extracts and suppresses different harmonics to produce a richer, maybe more, in some cases, more mellow sounds.
Wow. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Mike in Ithaca. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Yeah, hi. I wanted to comment that in 1968, I believe it was, possibly 69, I can't remember which, but as an undergraduate, I took a course called Bionics and Robots. And it was normally lectured by Dr. Block in the Theoretical Applied Mechanics at Cornell, but one of the lectures we had to go was one given by Robert Moog.
Fantastic.
He was already quite famous, so he's only occasionally on the Cornell campus, even though he's a professor here, so he only was here that one day. But Switched on Bach had just came out, and when he saw the size of the audience, because a lot of people came, he dumbed down the lecture considerably. It was still interesting, but it wasn't the lecture we were supposed to get.
How did he react to his celebrity?
I think what he did with sensitivity. In other words, he still wanted to convey information, both historical and scientific, but when he saw the size of the audience, he had to dumb it down, both in terms of choice of material and how he spoke about it. I saw Ed Wilson do that at a lecture once, too, actually, on sociobiology. When he saw the size of the audience, he just dumbed down his lecture considerably. Yeah. Same kind of thing. It just shows great sensitivity, I guess, on the part of the lecturer.
Yeah.
Interesting. Thanks for calling, Mike.
Thank you.
Nice music was great, too, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Nice remnant. Yeah, thank you. 1-800-989-8255. So did he go touring around lecturing? Do you know?
I think he did somewhat. As I met him as a graduate student, part of, you know, what his gig was to do a lecture with that. He appeared to me to be a fairly uncomfortable lecturer. He didn't seem to have a lot of, you know, of that pizzazz of a lecturer and interaction with the audience. And so maybe that's why I remember more why he really seemed to be in his element as he was staring at the insides of this machine.
And he sold his company, right? He did not keep...
This seems to be, you know, a relatively bitter part of his life. Sold his company in the early 70s, and then it's, you know, of course, you know, sold the name along with it. And I think in the last couple of years was able to finally get the name back, and was engaging in a limited production of some mini Moog types of synthesizers.
Yeah. 1-800-989-8255. Christopher in Kivaka, Florida. Hi, Christopher.
Hello there. I took a class with Robert Moog's wife in Asheville. I wanted to comment on that. They were preparing to go back to Japan.
Uh-huh.
He was really revered in Japan, I understand.
What
he was recognized in this country nicely, but over there they treated him pretty much almost as a god.
And he was. He was a god, yes.
In that respect, in early electronic stuff, he was just like their guru.
Some people have referred to him as the Einstein of music.
Yeah,
absolutely. It was an undeniable accomplishment.
Because it was so hard to do what he did, knowing, you know, you had to have the right melding of the two sides of your brain, I imagine.
Right.
The technical side and the musical side.
Right. Now, I'd like to mention that even though Moog is the person that has the bulk of the credit for developing the voltage-controlled modular synthesizer, there was one being developed on the West Coast literally at the same time.
Oh, really?
By Don Buchla. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to Don, and I said, gee, what's the timeline? And Don Buchla told me that he and Bob had agreed at one point both to share credit for the simultaneous development of this, that they weren't able to figure out who actually did the final invention or the final brainstorm first. So for electronic musicians, the Buchla and the Moog are sort of equivalent synthesizers.
Hmm. John in St. Louis. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah. Robert Moog was, as you say, a physicist, but he knew George Kelischek, a German violin maker who was a musician.
Uh-huh.
And I played along with him at the John C. Campbell Folk School, and Moog taught a class, and my two sons built a rudimentary synthesizer under his direction. He's a very gentle and kind man.
Wow, that's a fantastic story.
That's a great story. Thanks for sharing
also,
that with me. Yeah,
go
ahead.
I also ran across his, when he sold to Gibson,
uh-huh.
I ran across his marketing supervisor who Gibson took on, but he had quit and he was now selling electronic equipment for identifying cattle because they weren't interested in the instrument, really. So it was a sad thing when he sold it.
That's the story that I heard. I don't even know if it was Gibson per se. I think it may have been Gibson's parent company called Norlin.
Hmm.
And so I think Norlin is the sort of overriding corporate face of this takeover.
Thanks for calling, John. Our number 1-800-989-8255. We're talking about the Moog synthesizer this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Lawrence Fritz of the University of Iowa in Iowa City. Did anybody really improve on it, or, you know, what happened following that technology?
To my mind, the Moog sort of went downhill after the initial period of the 60s in which they had these big suitcase-sized modular synthesizers. Then they tried to sort of streamline it, make it smaller and more portable. Then there's this thing called the Mini Moog, which became very popular with improvising jazz musicians and so forth. It was very small and portable, but it had very minimal capabilities. So to my mind, to my taste, nothing really touches, you know, the big classic modular synthesizers of the 60s.
Mm-hmm. See if we get a call in quickly here. Hi, let's go to Chris in Minneapolis.
I just wanted to make a comment. Basically, in the intro, you're mentioning bands from the 60s and you're playing Bach, and it just struck me that it might leave an impression upon listeners that this was music of the past, but there are wonderful bands that are still using this technology. Stereolab is one of them, but there are others, and it's not been replaced by digital synthesizers.
No.
Well, I can attest to that. So in my electronic music studios here, we've just refurbished our Moog. One of the original Moog engineers named Mike Buckeye has a company called Modusonics, and he repairs vintage Moogs and even makes original modules to the original specifications. So, yeah, but certainly Radiohead, Nine Inch Nails, a lot of bands are using these classic analog Moogs.
So the digital world has not overtaken it?
It has not. Don't know where we're going on that. We're trying to get both worlds to talk to each other right now, so that's our goal.
Do you play one, Chris?
No, I just love the music. I don't play.
All right, that's good enough. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
So, what do you think history will say about Bob Moog?
Well, it's the Stradivarius instrument of the 1960s. These things are going to have to be preserved. They have certain characteristics, you know, certain resonant frequencies, certain modes of playing. And, you know, as time goes on and these instruments fall into disrepair, we're going to be losing the Stradivarius of the 60s.
Are there enough of them around to keep them alive?
Yes, I just talked to Mike Buckeye of Modusonics yesterday. He thinks that there were between 100 and 500 of the original modular synthesizers.
Uh-huh.
And so he's busy away, you know, soldering, you know, all these things back together as they come in. So hopefully we'll keep them around for a few years.
And you have to keep teaching people how to use it.
Well, they teach themselves. So thanks to the Internet, they're able to see tutorials on this. Your listeners might be interested on my website at the University of Iowa Electronic Music Studios. We have a classic set of Moog demonstrations done by Peter Todd Lewis in 1979. Mm. So type in Moog demo, and we have a half dozen or a dozen MP3 files that show the workings of the Moog.
Easier than that, go to sciencefriday.com. We have a link for you.
Great.
Up there already. I want to thank you, Lawrence, for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
And happy music to you.
Same to you.
Lawrence Fritz is a professor of composition and theory and the director of the Electronic Music Studios at the University of Iowa in Iowa City. This program is produced by Annette Heist, Anne-Marie Cunningham, and senior producer Kevin Berghoff. Charles Berquist is our director and web producer. And if you like, you want to find those links that we talked about to the synthesizer, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. We have links to everything we talked about today. And also, we have a podcast there waiting for you. If you want to take this show with you or other shows that we've played in the last few months, we're now podcasting Science Friday. You can stick it on your iPod or other player and take it with you. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.